Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, October 2nd, 2014. A UNICEF representative in South Sudan says hundreds of thousands of people are still suffering, especially children.
We're finding lots and lots of kids without their parents who are surviving with their relatives or with their friends. They don't know where their families are. We've got severe malnutrition, acute malnutrition rates that are way above global standards in terms of emergency thresholds.
And Parliament puts off voting on national security bill again.
But now when we are independent, I think we should make the image of the country according to the will of the people. It's not to go against the will of the people any longer.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. United States says it's giving an additional $83 million to NGOs that provide emergency assistance to hundreds of thousands of people displaced in South Sudan and others living as refugees in neighboring countries. That brings to $720 million the amount of U.S. provided to emergency aid for South Sudan last fiscal year. Carol Van Damme spoke with a representative for one of the aid agencies that will get the money, who says the new U.S. funds are sorely needed and coming just in time.
Jonathan Veach is the top UNICEF representative in South Sudan. He says UNICEF and the UN World Food Program reached more than 500,000 people, including 100,000 children under the age of five, in 25 joint emergency missions during the last year. Using helicopters and planes, they delivered food assistance, vaccinations, and hygiene supplies to some of the most remote areas of South Sudan. Veach says the 500,000 people the two aid agencies have reached may sound like a lot, but it is really just a drop in the bucket in a country the size of South Sudan.
It's not enough. You know, the 1.8 million have been displaced in total, and around 1.3 million of them are inside South Sudan. The rest have gone to neighboring countries. So we've reached 500,000, which is remarkable in itself, but there's still a lot of people still out there in really remote villages that are very hard to reach.
Veach says using airdrops and airlifts to deliver supplies is expensive, but security concerns and the onset of the rainy season mean there is no other option.
It's not a way that we would normally want to do business. We like to pre-position supplies, but a lot of our supplies were looted during the early days of the conflict. And then the rains came, and so we have to reach by air. And we're literally dropping the food from aircraft and then sending multi-sectoral response teams onto the ground to try and vaccinate kids, register them, see whether we can find teachers, schools, give them nutritional supplies, and then move on to the next location.
Veach says what they find with children is particularly disturbing.
So I think these children have been displaced sometimes multiple times. We're finding lots and lots of kids without their parents who are surviving with their relatives or with their friends. They don't know where their families are. We've got severe malnutrition, acute malnutrition rates that are way above global standards in terms of emergency thresholds.
On top of that, Veach says, many children have witnessed horrific violence.
And we've even got a situation where over 10,000 children have been recruited into armed forces since the conflict last year. And we have to find them and we have to get them out.
Veach says even though the leaders of both sides have signed a commitment to stop using child soldiers and release the ones they have, children are still being used by both rebel and government forces.
What we're seeing on the ground is massive, grave child rights violations. We're seeing recruitment by particular commanders, not only on the opposition side, but also on the government SPLA side. We're seeing occupation of schools. We're seeing looting and destruction of hospitals and all the other violence that constitutes crimes, both in international law and in South Sudanese law.
Veach says that even with the new funding pledge from the United States, UNICEF and the World Food Program will not be able to reach all the people in need in the war-torn country. He says there's only one way to end the cycle of suffering in South Sudan.
Well, you know, like all humanitarian crises that are man-made, the only way for it to be resolved is to have peace.
Peace talks are continuing in Ethiopia, but there have been very few signs of progress. Carol Van Damme for VOA News, Washington.
We move to Juba, where South Sudan's parliament today postponed a vote on National Security Service Bill for a second time this week. Samuel Duor Deng, chairperson of Parliament's Defense, Security and Public Order Committee, says MPs will likely bring up the legislation for a final vote next week. But as Philip Thornaleo reports for VOA from Juba, opponents of the bill in its current form say it gives security operatives too much power.
Ruling SPLM party lawmakers met separately to reach agreement on the drop bill before the start of today's sessions. Following a brief discussion within the SPLM caucus, the speaker announced the postponement of today's sessions, which was meant to discuss and pass the bill. Some lawmakers say the revised bill does not incorporate some of the proposed changes brought up earlier, such as placing restrictions on the right of national security officers to arrest suspects without warrants. But they insist all recommendations made by the MPs in the previous debate have been inserted in the document.
We have actually done a lot of that in those areas. There were some few issues that were raised, like power to arrest. And then in the same provision says any person. That was oversight, and we said it has to be suspect. And then the way we have actually put it in our last report wouldn't have been the problem. But the problem is that most of our members did not read the full text to know what is actually the changes we have done.
Deng says today's delay will give MPs more time to read through the entire base bill before it comes up for a vote, possibly as early as next week. Onyoti Adigo, Parliament's minority leader, says it should not be the role of security officers to arrest people. Adigo says he opposes sections 12 and 50 of the bill, which give security officers the power to seize property and arrest suspects.
This is not according to the Constitution, because in our Constitution, Article 159E, talk of national security being professional in its mandate and shall focus on information gathering, analyze them, and then after analyzing them, advise to the relevant authority to take action. That is in the Constitution. Even in this, in the bill itself, if you go to the guiding principles, it's talking more or less the same which is in the Constitution. We are afraid of this because some people can abuse the powers, can arrest anybody. So why arrest people when security is supposed to be the one protecting the people?
Adigo says even the ruling SPLM party objected to such provisions before South Sudan gained independence from Sudan. He says he was a member of the SPLM at the time and clearly remembers the former rebel movement's demand for citizens' liberties.
But now when we are independent, I think we should make the image of the country according to the will of the people. It's not to go against the will of the people any longer.
Deng says people rights will be protected under the current bill.
It's going to be very nice for us to have that bill, because it protects both the service operations and the people of South Sudan and the interests of the country itself.
Some lawmakers also blink at provision in the bill that gives security operatives the right to monitor electronic communications. MPs say such a law infringes on people's rights to privacy as is stipulated in the transitional constitution. Deng notes not every telephone call will be monitored by security officers.
We will not let them hack the telephones or individual telephones. It will be only, you know, the thing to do with issues of espionage, conspiracy, and, using these electronic devices and all this. And then that is it. And then you will now be breaching the Article 19.4. That talk of right of individuals. So we have actually tried as much as possible to avoid all this inconvenience.
Adigo Arch. The bill, in its current form, also gives security agents immunity from facing criminal charges. He says that provision must be removed.
Number one thing is the nation. The image of the nation is very bad now, so we need to make it better. We will make it better when the international community sees that we have got better laws, which are more or less of the international standard. This is what we need.
Adigo says his party, which holds the most opposition party seats in parliament, secretly hopes members of the majority SPLM party will agree to insert all the proposed changes before the bill comes up for a vote. The bill could pass without opposition support. The MPs are scheduled to go on the recess starting today, but due to the delays in passing the security bill, the break was cancelled until further notice. For BOA News, I am Philip Thornaleo in Juba.
Residents of the capital of Warab State have a different complaint. They say there is a major fuel shortage in their town. Petrol station owners say starting a few days ago, lorries that were supposed to deliver fuel to them have been stuck on impassable roads somewhere between Juba and Kwajok. But state government and officials and ordinary citizens say the latest problem shows just how urgent it is to improve the road network in South Sudan. For VOA News, Santino Manut Ayuel has this report from Kwajok.
Voda Voda operator Manun Menyen is waiting to be served at the only retail gas station in the middle of Kwajok's main market. He needs to buy a liter and a half bottle of gasoline so that he can keep his motorbike taxi service up and running. A few days ago, one of these bottles of petrol cost 15 South Sudanese pounds. But today, a bottle is going for 25 South Sudanese pounds. That is hurting small business like Manyen.
It's a struggle for us to get 20 pounds, and then we have to pay all that money for fuel. Then if no one uses our taxi service, we end up going back home with nothing. It's even worse now that all the petrol stations around here are closed.
Some boda boda operators and bus drivers have already increased the fares they charge by 50%. Manyin says clients are unable to pay the high fares and have stopped using boda boda taxis. That means some taxis operators have shut up shop for the time being. The main gas station in Kwajok, Star Gas Petrol, has been closed for more than 2 weeks. And Mohamed Mahmoud, the station manager, says he does not expect to reopen anytime soon. He blames the closure on South Sudan's very four highways, most of which are unpaved and become impassable during the rainy season, which is in full swing now.
Due to problem of the roads, that is why our station is closed. No fuel. Our vehicles which loaded fuel, petrol and diesel, they are on the way. They are stuck. 2 weeks now, 14 days, we are unable to work.
Mahmoud pleaded with the national government to refer the country's major roads to ease transportation-related problems like the fuel shortage. These problems are predictable and tend to repeat themselves every year, he says. Meanwhile, the fuel shortage in Kwajok is having a ripple effect on business activities around Warao State and beyond. Mohamed Wall says he and other drivers who operate transportation services around the road linking Kwajok to Wao in neighboring Western Barrel Kazal State have increased fares by around 20%.
We had 10 pounds, the fries of Atos to be 70 because of the fuel. The price of the fuel is now inflated. Jerkan is 250, and last time it was 120 pounds.
Warao State Information Minister Paul Dalgum says state officials are doing their best to improve the road. The state government recently started to refer the highway linking Kwajok to Western Barrel Kazal State, for instance. But Gum says it is the responsibility of national government to fix many of the roads that are impassable right now. He says government in Juba needs to start working immediately on improving South Sudan's infrastructure.
I want to take the opportunity to tell the national government that our people are crying in your name. People of Arab State are crying that prices have risen in the market, there is no fuel in the market, there is no medicines in the market, simply because of the roads. And therefore, our colleagues in the National Ministry of Road have to urgently intervene and have the roads repaired.
National Roads and Bridges Ministry officials says they plan to construct several highways and bridges across the country within the next few years. They say this will promote trade and development both inside South Sudan and outside its borders. But it wasn't clear if the road would be paved or if they would be made of the same mix of gravel and dirt as other roads in South Sudan that become impassable every time the rains come. For VOA News, I am Santino Manut Ayuel in Kwajok, Warao State.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a new school opens in one of East African countries aiming to increasing the rate of girls graduating from secondary schools. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what can ordinary people do to help stop corruption?
Corruption starts within you. That is from the person that really has to do something with anything. Because at the end of the day, it's you who will either bribe a policeman or bribe someone to get something. So sometimes it's us to really go through the right way and forget about shortcuts and all that. And that will try and avoid corruption.
Anything that you have to pay for something, you pay to get a service. But also, we can also help to stop it by reporting whoever is engaged in it.
Make sure if you're getting into a situation which will make you give a bribe or get corrupt, don't indulge into it. Avoid it because it starts with you.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. A new school for girls in Tanzania was recently announced by the Denver, Colorado-based nonprofit Africa School Assistance Project. The Kapunda Project for Girls is a comprehensive program to increase secondary school graduation rates for girls in East Africa. It also aims to empower young women to make a better life for themselves now and for the future generations. Susan Bahar is the executive director of the Africa School Assistance Project. She spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis about the school.
The Kapunda Project for Girls is designed to increase graduation rates for girls in East Africa. And what we've designed is a replicable model that can be used at secondary schools, primarily in rural areas, to provide girls with a holistic set of supports so that they can access secondary school and ultimately succeed in secondary school. The genesis of the Kapunda Project is really, you know, after 8 years of working in the realm of education development in rural East Africa, we found that girls, after they went through primary school, there was a terrible drop-off in terms of girls' ability to continue with their schooling. In most countries in East Africa, there is a transition rate from primary school to secondary school of only about 36%, and it's even worse for girls. So when we started looking at why that was the case, we realized that if we wanted to do something to turn that around for girls, we couldn't come up with one single solution that would solve the problem for them. It really needs to be a comprehensive set of solutions for girls. And so we designed the Kapunda Project to support them in a number of different ways.
How will the school empower young girls?
First, we provide dormitory for girls at the secondary schools so that they have a safe and protected place to live and study. And that protects them against sexual assault when they're walking back and forth from school, long distances to get to secondary school in most cases. And oftentimes, sadly, girls are sexually assaulted on those long walks back and forth to school. They become pregnant and they have to drop out of school. That's the end of their education. So by having a dormitory where they can live and be protected, that's a pretty big piece of the puzzle. The second thing that we're doing as part of the Kapunda Project is we're providing the girls with a set of academic supports that will improve the quality of their education. We're building science laboratories at the schools so they can better learn physics and biology and chemistry and math. We're building computer labs so that they can access not only the internet, but they can have better resources for which to complete their schoolwork. We're doing teacher training for the teachers at the schools and tutoring programs to get the girls up to their grade level. We also need to support the girls in terms of their personal development. We provide nutrition and clean drinking water and sanitation facilities so that girls don't have to stop going to school for 1 week out of every month. We also layer on top of everything else a girls' leadership program so that the girls will be inspired to become leaders in their own communities, to perhaps own a business, to perhaps hold political office, to perhaps go on to higher education, whatever she's inspired to do. By showing girls what they can attain, we hope that girls can achieve their fullest potential.
How many girls are at the school and how do they get into the school?
The number of girls that we're going to be serving at this first implementation of the Cupanda Project will serve 144 girls at a rural secondary school outside of the city of Mwanza. It's on the banks of Lake Victoria in northern Tanzania. How the girls are chosen to participate is done in partnership with Africa School Assistance Project, but also with the community itself. So we set up a number of checks and balances so that no one person or set of people have full power to choose the girls. And we're trying to protect against any one person who's in a position of power being able to say, well, I want my daughter in. We really want to choose the girls based on the highest need. So how far away do the girls live from the secondary school? If a girl lives 1 kilometer away, she's probably not as good of a candidate for the program as a girl who lives 12 kilometers away. And then on top of that, we'll overlay academic aptitude, girls who have shown a particular interest or aptitude in school. We'll overlay on top of that need, financial need. So we'll look at a number of factors.
So the response sounds like it's very positive in the communities that families want their girls to attend the school and to get education.
Yes, we have found that to be true. Now, I feel reluctant to make a blanket statement about all fathers and mothers and brothers in rural East African communities, but I can tell you that where we've been working, we have found the families to be very supportive of the girls to not only get an education, but to participate in the Cupanda Project.
That was Susan Bahar, Executive Director of the Africa School Assistance Project. She spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis from New York City. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. The defense chief for the besieged northern Syrian town of Kobani says a large-scale massacre by Islamic State militants is imminent without international aid. In an exclusive interview with VOA, Ismet Sheikh Khan says Kurdish fighters defending the area feel abandoned by U.S.-led coalition forces despite nearby airstrikes in recent days. Texas health officials are monitoring 80 people for possible exposure to Ebola, including up to 18 who had direct contact with a Liberian man who is the first patient in the U.S. to be diagnosed with the virus. Spokeswoman for the Dallas County Health Department said none of those being monitored are showing symptoms. And finally, the deadline issued by student pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong for the territory's chief executive to resign is approaching, but officials have shown no sign of giving in. The protesters have threatened to take over several government buildings if Beijing-friendly chief executive Yang Chengling refuses or fails to step down by midnight local time. And that's a look at today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
Norwegian Church Aid today wrapped a one-week course in Kwajok where women were taught leadership and business skills. NCA officials say the training is aimed at empowering women at the grassroots so that they can help their communities and the country. For VOA News, Santino Monuda Yuel has more from Warap State Capital, Kwajok.
Some of the skills the 50 women who took part in the training learned were how to mobilize capital to start their own business, how to use loans, how to effectively manage a business, and how to work in a group. 20-year-old Akwagmayar says she acquired valuable knowledge at the week-long workshop. She says she wants to use her new skills to start a small business. She also wants to help other women, she says.
For my own salons, I will be doing something good because it will help me. How you can use money, and if you start business, personal business, you will know the step that you will follow so that you will achieve or you will benefit from it. It will help us a lot.
Another participant in the workshop, Adil Majok, says she learned useful decision-making skills during the week of training with the NCA. She says she hopes to create some sort of income-generating activity that helps her community.
If you are a group, you must have peace to each other and also to create capital. That group can join hands together and contribute what little you have, and that little can help the community.
NCA official Lily Ismail says her organization organized training because it believes that putting women in leadership roles and letting them be part of the decision-making process will help restore peace in South Sudan. Once peace is restored, the country can focus on development, Ismail says. She says her organization wants to empower South Sudanese women with the knowledge and leadership skills that they need to fully participate in building the nation.
We need to see women participate in the all public space. We need to see women are involved in anything for decision making. That is why these skills are very important for them in basic human rights, gender and equality.
Madun Malwal Wall, head of Women Empowerment Section at NCA, says that with the new leadership skills under their belts, South Sudanese women have taken an important step away from years of reliance on humanitarian aid. That will help not only the women, but also the country of South Sudan to grow and prosper, he says.
We need to build up the capacity of knowledge of the people, especially the poor women. I think if the women become strong, the South Sudan will be more strong.
In addition to business skills, the women also learned about basic human rights, local government act, and how to claim and defend their rights. But probably the most important skills the women were taught was how to use leadership skill to positively change the lives of people in their communities and eventually in the country as a whole. For VOA News, I'm Santino Manudayuel in Kwajok, Warabu State.
That was our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Sura Yako by Sauti Sol. We have been listening to Sauti Sol and the song Surayako. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.